of death wait on thy end.
Hear now the words. Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
March 1962. Work is advancing on equipment and plans for the two-man Gemini flights and also the three-man Apollo shots to the moon. But it is deemed imperative first to give both astronauts and engineers more experience by further Mercury flights. Next in line is Air Force Captain Donald K. Slayton, the country boy from Wisconsin, most experienced test pilot of the original seven, who once declared,
"I would give my left arm to be the first man in space."
He missed that first, but is content to follow Glenn as the fourth American in space. Then suddenly, after 10,000 hours of intense training, Deke Slayton gets a catastrophic medical verdict.
"This is a diagnosis of paroxysmal atrial fibrillation."
In other words, every now and then, Deke Slayton's heart goes into an irregular beat. It hasn't affected him the least in testing jet planes. But can he take the strains of spaceflight? Can NASA risk having him die in his capsule? On March 15th, NASA announces that Deke Slayton has been replaced for Flight MA-7 by Scott Carpenter. Deke comments,
"And of course my feelings, I think, are very obvious. I was damn disappointed, let's face it."
Officially, Deke has been grounded for only this next spaceflight. Then the next, and the next. Obstinately, he declares,
"My feeling about it has been, well, hell, I'll keep fighting it, and one of these days I might beat him, and until I do, as long as I can contribute something to the program doing what I'm doing, I don't know of anything else I'd rather be doing."
It is his destiny to find his space career on the ground. As more pilots come into the program, a supervisor is required. Deke is the one and only choice of the pilots themselves.
"I can't be flying personally. I want to be as close to it as I can. And I don't know anybody else in the world that's got a good program as we have."
On April 26, 1962, we manage finally to touch a finger to the moon 3 years after the Russians. Ranger 4, shot into space to photograph the moon, travels the almost 250,000 miles in 64 hours and crashes on the dark side of the moon as planned. But there are no pictures. The cameras have gone out of commission. Early in May, Russian cosmonaut German Titov, hero of a 17 orbit flight, visits the United States on a goodwill tour.
"Я взял с собой несколько фотографий в полет.
I took several photograph with me into the flight."
He also declares he would be afraid to attempt a joint space flight with an American on the grounds that U.S. equipment is not good enough. Further, he denies that Russia has had any failures whatsoever and reports that he saw no God or angels during his orbits of the Earth. May 24th, 1962. Navy test pilot Scott Carpenter goes up in the capsule he's named Aurora 7 in honor of the goddess of dawn.
"I feel the liftoff. The clock has started."
"Roger.
Loud and clear, Gus."
He is to repeat Glenn's three-orbit mission of 3 months ago and make some additional experiments and observations.
"If anybody reads, I have the fireflies. They are very bright."
He incidentally solves the mystery of John Glenn's fireflies when his hand strikes the hatch and a shower of sparks flies off outside his window. Frost particles is what they turn out to be. Also, Carpenter takes valuable space photos and is the first astronaut to sample the condensed food in squeeze bags, especially prepared for spaceflight.
Yes, I have. However, the food has crumbled badly, and I hate to open the package anymore for fear of getting crumbs all over the capsule. I can verify that eating bite-sized food as we've packaged for this flight is no problem at all. Even the crumbly foods are eaten with no problem.
But he runs into a pack of trouble. Early in the flight, his spacesuit overheats, putting him into a mild sweat. He uses up too much fuel on the first and third orbits and is therefore directed to let the capsule drift without using any attitude controls. Even so, he winds up with barely enough for a controlled re-entry. Then, his retro rockets fail to go off automatically, and he hits the manual button 3 seconds late, with the capsule slightly off the precise position for re-entry. Rushing toward Earth, momentarily in the usual radio blackout, Carpenter soliloquizes into his in-cabin tape recorder.
There was a flaming piece coming off. Almost looked like it came off the tower.
In the crisis, to relieve his own tension, he falls back on the beloved Jose Jimenez gag.
Oh, I hope not.
A reference to a passage in the fictional press interview of astronaut Jose.
What is this called? A crash helmet?
Oh, I hope not.
Carpenter splashes down some 200 miles off target, far from the ships and their helicopters waiting to recover him. 3 hours after he has hit water, a helicopter picks him up. Carpenter's near tragedy serves as a reminder that 88 minutes in orbit is still far more dangerous than 88 minutes on a commuter train. His wife, Reen, asked again and again by interviewers whether she was nervous, replies,
I wasn't nervous. It was a great day. I loved every minute of it. And I could hardly wait to write it down when it was over. And I have to say that glimpse you get of the woman in front of the house is such an innocuous, brief thing. Every woman has her own identity. She's not just the apple pie thing waiting back home, and she's probably had to take a tranquilizer pill to step out in front. And then the interviewer says, oh, you know, I want you to introduce you to the lovely photogenic family of Commander Westlake. And Mrs. Westlake, were you happy, thrilled, and proud? And she says, yes, I guess I was. And he says, and this is your little boy, Dickie. And Dickie, you want to be an astronaut when you grow up? I guess I do. And this is his sister, Mary. And Mary, what do you want to be when you grow up? Well, I guess I just want to grow up. And isn't that thrilling? Well, you've heard from the lovely family of our astronaut. And then she...
Having probed space, her husband, the restless traveler, will in a few years go completely the other way, to the bottom of the ocean, by joining the Navy's Deep Submergence Systems Project. Over the summer of 1962, Algeria, with plastic bombs, fights for independence from France, and finally wins it with the blessing of Charles de Gaulle, whom the French generals had called back to power precisely to prevent independence. Egypt test fires 4 small rockets and declares, we have entered the space age. Nevertheless, exactly 5 years hence, its entire air force will be wiped out in 15 minutes by Israel. All summer long, Navy Commander Wally Schirra trains for our next space shot, MA-8, which is to be an engineering flight, as against Glenn's exploratory flight and Carpenter's developmental and scientific shot. With this in mind, he names his capsule Sigma, an engineering symbol for summation. As the son of a World War I ace and a barnstorming mother, he was airborne as a tot even before he was legborne. A high-spirited charmer, he's a leader of an unofficial club at Cape Canaveral whose password and countersign go like this.
Are you a turtle?
You bet your sweet I am.
But suddenly, on August 11th, the laughter freezes as Radio Moscow makes another of its sudden announcements.
Thank you.
we learned that a third Soviet cosmonaut, Major Adrian G. Nikolaev, has been launched into orbit aboard Vostok 3. A day later, cosmonaut number 4, Lieutenant Colonel Pavel R. Popovich, is shot into the same orbit. Within an hour, we are told, Popovich has made radio contact with Nikolaev. Soon after, Nikolaev sights his friendly pursuer, and they do 47 complete orbits of the Earth in adjacent flight, close enough to see each other's spacecraft most of the time. August 15th, 4 days after the first launch, both cosmonauts return safely to Earth. Nikolaev has racked up a record 64 orbits, and Popovich, his junior partner, 48. It adds up for Nikolaev to a sensational 1,645,000 miles in 95 hours and 25 minutes of flying time. During their flight, President Kennedy, in a television address, congratulates the Russians on an extraordinary achievement. Further, he states,
I know that many of you have your eyes fixed in space and are interested and concerned about the extraordinary accomplishment of the Soviet Union in that area. I have said from the beginning that this country started late in the 1950s. We are behind and will be behind for a period in the future. But we are making a major effort now, and this country will be heard from.
We are heard from, as it happens, exactly 7 weeks later. On October 3rd, 1962, Wally Schirra suits up and tells a couple of friends, I've got nothing better to do today, so I guess I'll take a trip around the world.
I have lift off, clock has started. Fancy feels real nice. Oh, she's riding beautiful, Dick.
At 3 minutes and 39 seconds, communicator Dick Slayton asks the secret password.
Are you a turtle today?
You bet your sweet ass I am.
Good time to get you on that one.
MA-8 becomes a textbook mission as Wally circles the Earth on his 6 scheduled orbits. The Atlas booster that hurled him into space threw him to a peak altitude of 152.8 miles, about 8 miles higher than intended. Only one other problem develops. As Wally passes over Africa on his first orbit, his suit begins to heat up, just as Scott Carpenter's did.
The suit temp is now stunning, still going up a little bit, about 7.2. I am setting a suit temperature of number 5, and I'll give it a little more time to try to cool down.
By the time he reaches Mexico, the cabin temperature is up to 100 degrees. But Wally solves the problem all on his own. As the astronaut who specialized on design of the spacesuit at the start of the program, he knows as much about it as anybody in Mercury Control. After a couple of hours of tinkering...
Now, Deke, I finally got a grasp on this thing where I'm beginning to feel a little cooler, and the suit inlet temperature is now down to 7.6. I'm getting cooler. The suit inlet is now about 7.5 to 7.6. So I am making progress, but I'd rather not throw in the sponge on the settings I have so far.
In his last sunrise of the day, Wally comes to the end of his mission. He puts the capsule in position for re-entry by aiming it at several stars and planets, including Jupiter. Then leaves it to the automatic controls to fire the retro rockets and shoot him home. On his way down, he reports,
oh, boy, she's a good little capsule, I'll clue you. I think they're going to put me on number 3 elevator.
Good show. Stand by, I'll call the Cape, see if they have anything.
He splashed down a scant 2.5 miles off target, northeast of Midway Island, scene of an historic naval battle of World War II. He's flown his 6 orbits in some 9 hours, a normal business day for Earthbound workers. And for more than a third of the time, at negligible expense to the taxpayer, he simply drifted in his fixed orbit without using fuel. In his confidential self-debriefing, he expresses esteem for his capsule.
I definitely fell in love with Capsule 16. Capsule 16 the crew that prepared that bear, the flight itself, truly is a high point in my life.
19 days later, the sharp space rivalry of America and Russia comes down to Earth in what the current phrase calls an eyeball-to-eyeball confrontation. One that threatens the entire future of both Earth and space.
This government, as promised, has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba. Within the past week,
on October 22, 1962, President Kennedy, in a grim but matter-of-fact television talk, warns the American people that Russia has emplaced launch pads and nuclear missiles in Castro's Cuba.
The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere. Each of these missiles, in short, is capable of striking Washington, D.C., the Panama Canal, Cape Canaveral, Mexico City, or any other city in the southeastern part of the United States.
We set up a naval quarantine of Cuban waters to prevent the Russians from delivering any more missiles. The Strategic Air Command is put on alert, and invasion troops are prepared. We are on the edge of war. At the last moment, Khrushchev backs down and takes his missiles home. As top scientists and other public figures continue to attack manned moon flight as wasteful and useless, NASA Administrator James E. Webb replies,
"The main benefit to the United States and the manned space program is to learn how to operate in space with men. To select the target of a lunar landing is to focus." This is a step-by-step program in which we are gaining experience as rapidly as we can without going into what might be called a crash program.
Project Mercury speeds up its schedule. Because of Shiraz's success, a second flight of 6 orbits is canceled in favor of an 18-orbit shot or more. A batch of 9 new astronauts goes into training for the 2-man flights, Gemini, that will follow Mercury. The public hears names that will not make an impression for yet another 3 or 4 years. Neil Armstrong, Pete Conrad, Tom Stafford, Ed White. On December 14th, it is announced that a U.S. space probe launched 109 days earlier is flying past the planet Venus, 36 million miles across space, and maintaining radio communication with the Earth. From Venus, it continues onward the same distance to go into eternal orbit around the Sun. As we go into 1963, Air Force Major Gordon Cooper, youngest of the original 7, is named to fly the next Mercury flight. After much deliberation, he names it Faith 7, explaining,
"I selected Faith 7 as the name of my spacecraft for 3 reasons. Faith is defined in the dictionary as belief, loyalty, and confidence. Belief in God and country, a loyalty to organization, and a confidence in the entire Mercury team."
A life insurance company supports Gordo Cooper's faith by writing the first commercial policies for the astronauts, including Cooper. Space photography is to be the special feature of Faith 7 to such an extent that Cooper describes his mission as a flying camera. An Oklahoma boy who has never lost his country drawl, Gordo Cooper is the all-American outdoorsman.
"All Mercury stations, be advised, this mission today is scrubbed. Stand by for a recycle."
On May 14th, 1963, he waits 6 hours in his capsule, only to have $1 billion worth of the world's most advanced equipment frustrated by an engine with a dirty fuel line that fails to pull away the gantry and a defective radar computer in Bermuda. Gordo, still waiting wistfully, asks Paul Donnelly in the blockhouse,
"Sure you can't run out with a Zippo and light this thing, Paul?"
"Say again?"
"You sure you can't run out and light the fuse with your little Zippo?"
"No, I guess not today, Gordo."
"All right.
We'll give her hell tomorrow."
"Okay."
And hell they give them. Next day is perfection. Over Africa, Asia, and Mexico, like an eager tourist, Gordo drinks in the sights from 100 miles up and more. Roads, rivers, villages, even individual houses when the light is right. He releases a flashing beacon into space to test whether he can judge distances and reports,
"I was with that little rascal all night last night."
On his 14th pass, racing over Australia into the South Pacific, a reverent mood comes upon him, and he suddenly finds himself composing a prayer.
"I would like to take this time to say a little prayer for all the people, including myself, involved in this launch and this operation. Father, thank you for the success we have had in flying this flight. Thank you for the privilege of being able to be in this position, to be in this wondrous place, seeing all these many startling, wondrous things that you've created. Help guide and direct all of us that we may shape our lives to be good, that we may be much better Christians."
He finds time to direct a TV show starring himself on an in-cabin TV camera, makes numerous navigational tests. Then suddenly, passing over Hawaii on his 19th orbit, trouble. A light comes on in the spacecraft which indicates that it has prematurely started a series of automatic maneuvers that should not occur until after the retro rockets have fired and the capsule is well on its way home.
"I wonder if you'd relay to the Cape the situation I had happened and see what they think on it. While turning my warning lights off and back on to dim, my 05G telelight came on in my telelight panel. Now the action that I have taken is to turn off my 05G switch fuse and my emergency 05G switch fuse. Would you relay to them and get their idea on it? Over."
To stop the wasteful process, Cooper switches off some of the automatic controls. This means he may have to fly himself home. It worries the engineers and controllers down below. It doesn't bother Cooper at all. That's what he's up there for, to take over as a trained pilot when the machines fail. Then more trouble. Power fails on the autopilot, which was to hold the capsule in position during re-entry. Now Cooper will have to perform all the re-entry maneuvers by himself. And then Cooper finds that the carbon dioxide level is rising in his suit, making breathing a little difficult. Passing over Zanzibar, off the coast of Africa, he wryly takes stock of his situation.
"Well, things are beginning to stack up a little. ASCS inverter is acting up. And my CO2 is building up in the suit. Partial pressure of O2 is decreasing in the cabin. Standby inverter won't come on the line. And other than that, things are fine."
52 minutes later, he's talking with John Glenn again, who asks him about his retro attitude. Cooper replies, "The retro rockets fire, and as Faith 7 begins its return back to Earth, John Glenn calls,
"John, thank you."
34 hours and 20 minutes after liftoff, Cooper splashes down in the Pacific, 4 miles from the recovery ship, again the carrier Kearsarge. From inside the capsule, he calls with mock formality,
"I'd like to come aboard the carrier if they'll grant me permission for an Air Force troop."
He's experienced 22 days and nights during the day and a half of Earth time between launch and splash, and has lost 7 pounds. Scientists will dispute that he could see from on high all the things you described. He will tell them.
Now, there have been numerous discussions and numerous attempts to justify or refute what I saw on the flight. However, as I say, I was there and
and on his own Gemini flight, he will be proved right. Following Cooper's flight, Mercury Associate Director Walt Williams declares that the project has achieved its goals.
"Mercury now is dead, is a good way to describe it. The program is closed. When we started it, our object was to prove man's capability in space. And I think the record shows that man is capable in space. Man has a place in space."
It has cost $384 million, and at its peak involved 2 million people.
Some concepts.
There is one brief section in the final Mercury report that will haunt us and then strike home with tragedy 3 years from now. It is that even on Gordon Cooper's superb flight, his spacecraft contained 720 flaws, largely caused by faulty workmanship. Backstage, out of the public view, work pushes ahead simultaneously on both Gemini and the ultimate moon flight program, Apollo. But it will be 22 months before an American goes into space again. And Russia laps us once again with the first woman in space and the first space romance. On June 14, 1963, Lieutenant Colonel Valery Baikovsky takes off in Vostok 5. 2 days later, a robust, smiling factory worker and parachute fan, Valentina Tereshkova, with the reserve rank of lieutenant, is launched in Vostok 6. Shortly after entering orbit, she comes within 3 miles of Baikovsky. 3 days later, they land, Valentina first. 5 months later, in November, Valentina marries cosmonaut Nikolaev, who flew Vostok 3, and the world smiles on the first cosmo couple in history. Suddenly, on November 22nd, grief blackens the world as a news bulletin comes from Dallas, Texas. John F. Kennedy, one of the best-known men on Earth, has been assassinated by one of the most obscure, a misfit named Lee Harvey Oswald, who thus finds a place in history as he could not in life. One week after the assassination, the new president, Lyndon Baines Johnson, by executive order, renames the Canaveral Space Center in memory of John F. Kennedy. Lyndon Johnson has long played a leading role in the space program, both as U.S. Senator and Vice President. As 1964 opens and he delivers his first State of the Union message to Congress, he urges,
"We must assure our preeminence in the peaceful exploration of outer space, focusing on an expedition to the moon in this decade, in cooperation with other powers, if possible, alone, if necessary."
In fact, rivalry will sharpen in the years just ahead as both sides take giant steps toward the moon.
I hope you have enjoyed what you have heard, and I look forward to your comments. Send those cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. The Campaign for Real Mail thanks you. No promises, but there's a good chance I'll read out whatever you send me. If you like these shows enough to support them, and you're not comfortable mailing envelopes full of cash, you can set up a recurring monthly tip for the storyteller at patreon.com/publius_reads.
That was Andres Segovia. Next is Joaquin Turina with Si Sidela S.A. Ringenera Life. That was Joaquin Turina. Next is Martin Jones with Kansas I Dances, Zidai. Thank you. That was Martin Jones. Next is Christian Jacotet with Jig. That was Christian Jacotet. Next is Massimo Corta with III. Presto. We'll be right back. That was Massimo Quarta. Next is Andre Segovia with Espla, Antino.
CQ, CQ, CQ. This is people. Time for munch on this testy ham radio. CQ, CQ, CQ. This is people. Time for munch on this testy ham radio.
Good morning, this is K7PAN opening the Puget Sound Voters Net. It's Friday, December 22nd, 2017. My handle is Chris and the QTH is Wes Ballard in Seattle. The net was formed to develop our skill and test our radio equipment for communications and safety. We're using the Puget Sound repeater group's repeater WW7PSR on Queen Anne Hill in Seattle at 146.96 MHz with Echolink enabled. It's an open net. Any hams welcome to join. If you want to check in or join the net, please respond when I ask for visitors after the end of the formal roll call. Before we begin the roll call, are there any priority communications? Just a quick note, at Rope Yarn last night, the place was jammed, standing room only. So, good time to get out and meet your fellow members. The roll call being the order of your call sign suffix. Please come back with your call sign, first name, location, and boat name when checking in. The net's particularly interested in local weather conditions and other items of import for members of the net. KD7BFA.
Good morning, Chris. Net, this is KD7BFA, and we are Tom Motor Vessel Friendship 2, QTH Spark Lift, where it's 37 degrees here this morning. 3 knots of wind out of the north, 30.22 and steady on the bar. Visibility is greatly reduced, somewhere around 10 miles. Sea states rippled, solid overcast. Olympics are totally obscured. And only partial of Bainbridge Island. The clouds are hanging right down into Bainbridge Island. 73, KD7BFA.
Good morning, Tom, and good to see you at lunch yesterday. Just keep coming. KG7CNQ.
Good morning, Chris, and good morning to the net. This is KG7CNQ, handle Mary Motor Vessel Black Diamond, and my QTH is at home in Kirkland this morning where it's just started raining. It's 39 degrees. The barometer's falling. Nice to have it warmer for my hummingbird water. And, I have a lot of hummingbirds throughout the winter, so I'm going to weigh in on that. Have a great day. KG7PN2.
Well, good morning, Mary. Yeah, I think we're going to get a hummingbird feeder. We were discussing it yesterday, and people said, well, the old people have bird feeders and stuff like that because they haven't got anything else to do. And I said, well, I've got plenty of other things to do, but it's kind of fun to watch them. And so we're going to get one for sure. And I was informed by those in the know that the hummingbirds will find me. I don't have to worry about that. Thanks for the report. K1 CRL.
Good morning, Chris. Good morning to the NAP. This is K1 CRL. It's Chuck, the vessel summation. UTH today is home in the Bozarts Forest, where it has actually stopped raining. It may start again soon, who knows. It's 38 degrees, total overcast as Tom reported. I've got a pressure at 30.23 this morning. Hope everybody has a great day, and that was a great rope burn last night, Chris. I echo your thoughts. This is K1 CRL.
Good morning, Chuck. Yeah, good to see you last night. VE7 DFJ.
Good morning, Chris and Annette. VE7 DFJ, Jack in Victoria, sailing vessel Majendee. Where this morning it's 37 degrees, it's cloudy. The sky is just covered with clouds. Pressure 30.2 inches, and it's fairly steady. Down a little bit than the last bit. Humidity is 93%. The wind is from the north at 7 knots. Visibility is reduced to about 10 miles. And our forecast for today is a chance of rain or wet flurries this morning, and then it's supposed to get sunny this afternoon and maybe sunny tomorrow. And, Chris, we live in a 55-plus development, so my neighbors and quite a few of them have hummingbird feeders, and we have quite a few of them that winter around here as well. The 70FJ.
Good morning, Jack. I kind of wonder where the hummingbirds go at night. Maybe they feed all the time. I don't know. But they're awful small, and they sure burn a lot of energy. So maybe they go find a leaf to crawl under. I'll have to ask Susan. N7DOS. KC3FLD.
Good morning, Chris. Good morning to everyone on the net. This is David overlooking Port Ludlow Bay, where it is 37 degrees. It's gray and overcast. The Olympics are totally obscured, but up north there seems to be a quite big white light, lighter spot up there. Barometer is at 30.34 and 73 is all, KC3FLD.
Good morning, David. Thanks for the Port Ludlow report. KB7GL.
Good morning, Chris and the net. KB7GL Vic in South Kirkland above Yarrow Bay, powerboat Chasa. Where it's currently overcast and it's been drizzly. I don't know if it's drizzling right now, but it drizzled all night. We've had about 0.06 since midnight, and we had about 0.11 prior to midnight. Started yesterday evening while we were downtown. It's currently 38 degrees, there's no wind, and the pressure has been falling slowly. It's currently 30.16 here at the QTH, and the relative humidity is sitting at 95%. Sorry we missed the happy hour. We did make a return trip to the Fifth Avenue, though, to watch our son perform in Holiday Inn, and the cast just keeps getting better and better, and this is just such a terrific show. So if you guys are interested, you have until December 31st to get a ticket and watch this this fun holiday show. Hummingbirds, I think they just kind of perch on branches and stuff. They don't feed at night. They just hole up, and they stay actually exposed to the elements. Even their nests are usually fairly exposed. I don't know how the little guys do it, but they somehow survive. 73 is all, and have a good day. KB7GL.
Morning, Vic. Well, hopefully we'll get the knowledgeable scoop from Susan. KE7HIP. N7KIA.
Yeah, good morning. This is Larry, N7KIA in Gig Harbor, where we have wall-to-wall gray this morning. Not only do we have gray, we've got wet. The streets are quite wet this morning. It's currently not raining, but must have had a few incidents overnight. A little light northerly going down through the narrows. Invisibility is not too bad. I can see over to Federal Way, so that's about 10 miles away. We're 38.7 degrees, 99% relative humidity, and 30.24 on the bar, and falling a little bit. The guesser's guessing rain, and it must have looked outside last night. So that's what's happening in Gig Harbor in 7KIA.
Morning, Larry. Well, it's a good lesser Seattle day. KE7, let's see, we need N7LED.
Good morning, Chris and Lynette. In 7LRE, handle Mary, Southbound Bandit, 58 Tom and Blue Ridge, and checking in for LED. Don't know what happened to us this morning. We just now woke up, and I looked at the clock, and went, oh, my word. So I don't even, I am outside on the deck, and the deck is wet. There's a breeze, I guess, there's a, yeah, it looks like we've got a nice breeze, must be from the north, and the deck is wet, but it's not raining at the moment. Anyway, 73 is all, and 7LRE.
Well, good morning, Mary. Too much fun at Rope Yarden last night, but that's okay. KI7LTR.
Hey, good morning, Chris. Good morning to the net. This is Neil, KI7LTR, powerboat Sequel, QTH Normandy Park. Weather here pretty much a ditto from what Larry's reporting in Gig Harbor. Solid, dark, low, overcast. The ground is wet, but it's not raining now. And there's nothing measurable on the rain gauge overnight, but it was snowing a little bit when I was out about an hour ago. Wind 3 to 5 out of the north. Mild chop on the water. Good visibility over the water. Probably 8 to 10 miles. Temperature here 40 degrees. Relative humidity 95%, and I get 30.21 and steady on the bar. Have a good day all. KI7LTR.
Hi, good morning, Neil. Good to hear from you this morning. This is K7PAN, handle Chris, Motorboat Panther, QTH, Sunset Hill, West Ballard, where we've got a dull, dark, gray day, heavy overcast. All of Bainbridge is in view, although, like Tom said, the clouds are down, I guess, to the tops of the trees over there. So you'd have to say, at least over there, the ceiling's probably a couple of hundred feet. And as Neil mentioned, the visibility on the water is pretty good. We got a light ripple out there. I'm showing 4 to 6 knots, generally from the south, but kind of variable. 38 degrees, 92% humidity. Wind is out of the, I'm not the wind, but the weather guesser says bright sunshine with small rain cloud. Go figure. Anyway, it's 30.1 on the bar and steady right now. And we've had about a tenth of an inch of rain since midnight, and it's wet everywhere here in West Ballard. This is K7PAN, K7PJC.
Good morning, Chris. Good morning to the net. K7PJC Phil, located up on Capitol Hill, Sailboat Runaway. Well, I'm looking out over Lake Union in the Sound. Got some overcast clouds. It's wet out, 39 degrees. It is lighter over here into the south compared to the west and the sound. 3 to 5 knots of breeze out of the south, 30.19 on the bar and steady. Weather guesser says sunshine and a little rain cloud. And Chris, you crack me up when you say old people watching hummingbirds. That's funny. Good morning, K7.